Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 8. Billy named the kitten he found Sparky, but when Callie asked him why, he just shrugged his shoulders and smiled. He had found the tiny creature on his way to her place that day, in an area to the west of the farm where the road passed through a swamp with enough standing water to warrant a small bridge at one end. Even though the water wasn't more than a few feet deep, the area served as a dump for objects the locals wouldn't dare dispose of anywhere else. In addition to used condoms and beer cans tossed by underage drinkers, the occasional unwanted pet wound up there too, sometimes in the water where they drowned, but sometimes beside it. Because of this, Billy and Callie always scrutinized that area carefully whenever they traveled through it. Examination of the tiny kitten quickly revealed that Sparky's feral mother, more likely than any human creep, had abandoned him there. Although quite weak, he fought courageously, but he couldn't keep Callie from opening his mouth and seeing the slit in the roof of it, cleft palate. He couldn't get enough to eat because the milk went through this hole and out his nose instead of into his stomach, she signed to Billy. She didn't tell him that any milk also could go into the kitten's lungs and cause him to die from pneumonia. "You fix him?" Billy replied. Even though Callie had amassed all the equipment and supplies necessary to treat just about any feline disease or injury, that she would need to repair birth defects on tiny emaciated kittens hadn't occurred to her when she made her purchases. She started to nod her head no, but the way Billy looked from Sparky to her made it impossible for her to tell him that. "I'll try," she signed instead. When Callie spayed kittens at the Los Angeles clinic, she would begin by programming herself to think small. Hundredths of a milliliter instead of tenths, and 4-aught or 6-aught instead of 2-aught suture. With Sparky, she performed the ritual twice because he was so much smaller and weaker. Once when she anesthetized him and set up an IV drip, and the second time when she picked up her instruments and prepared to repair the defect. Even so, her hands looked like gigantic, clumsy paws, and the instruments looked like heavy construction equipment in his tiny mouth. In spite of all that worked against her, Callie managed to repair the defect, and she and Billy began the most difficult part of the procedure, waiting. Although she cared if her surgery succeeded, she knew that Sparky's ability to recover from the anesthesia posed the more immediate danger. While Billy sat on the floor next to Nana and snuggled the kitten to keep him warm, she fixed some peanut butter crackers and apple slices, Billy's favorite snack, to distract herself as well as to please him. However, when she offered him the food, he declined, and for the briefest instant she thought the very sight and scent of it pained him. This caused her to clinically observe both him and Nana for the first time since her return. What she saw shocked her. How had the two of them grown so old so fast? She touched Billy's arm. "Are you feeling all right?" "Fine," he replied, pointing to the kitten who had emerged from the folds of his flannel shirt and stared groggily at the world. The nice thing about working with young animals is that they usually either make it or they don't in a relatively short time. Within a matter of hours, Sparky had recovered from the anesthetic and acted much like a normal kitten. Callie fed him through a nasogastric tube for a few days to give his mouth time to heal, but eventually she couldn't stall any longer. "Time for the moment of truth," she signed to Billy as she placed some soupy cat food in a saucer on the counter with Sparky. While the kitten sniffed it, she and Billy knelt on the floor, their eyes level with the countertop and the kitten so they could see if any food came out his nose. "Success!" she shouted, giving Billy a joyful hug when Sparky ate the food with nary a trace of it anywhere but on his whiskers. That night, Callie read and answered the latest installment from David regarding his impending marriage to Marilyn, while Sparky slept in her armpit and the other cats sprawled out in their usual locations. Previously, David had described in great detail how he had proposed to Marilyn during the annual meeting of the California Veterinary Medical Association and how they planned to marry in a formal garden belonging to Delhi Llamas, one of the top llama breeders in the state. "It's a gorgeous garden, but I worry that, given my position as a champion of pet population control, getting married at a breeding farm might convey the wrong message," he wrote in his latest epistle. "What do you think?" I think it's a darn good thing I didn't marry this guy, Callie told the cats. But she wrote him, Don't worry about it. I bet no one will even notice because they'll be so happy for you and Marilyn. The next day dawned gray and gloomy, and Callie arrived at the granary later than usual because one of the cats had thrown up, and she couldn't figure out which one. Depending on how she looked at it, they either all looked guilty or none of them did, so she finally gave up. At the store, she found a note from Joe saying that Billy wouldn't be able to work for her that afternoon. Past experience led her to assume that someone else needed his help, but that didn't keep the feeling that something troubled Billy from recurring. Gloom still hung over everything when Callie left the granary at noon, and she felt so lonely working without Billy that she gave up and walked to the beach. Although 5 miles distant by road, the ocean lay less than 2 miles from the house, using the path through the woods, a nice walk even on a lousy day. For as long as she could remember, she always walked to the beach whenever she needed to clear her head. During today's walk, she thought about Billy. What could be wrong? She immediately zeroed in on a physical problem, not because Billy's mental state lay beyond her comprehension, but because he was one of the most stable, happy people she knew. Oh, he's just happy because he's stupid, Chucky Getz once said when they were in the fourth grade, a remark that caused Callie to pin him and thump him soundly until he took it back. It wasn't that at all. Whatever Billy's limits for normal reasoning, he exhibited a remarkable capacity to understand in other ways. He always reminded Callie of an animal, not lesser in any way, but possessing senses and an almost palpable connection with all around him that she couldn't begin to comprehend. In the greater, natural scheme of things, he belonged. He understood. Had she possessed such knowledge plus the ability and the desire to relate to everyone in town, each in his or her own special way as Billy did, she imagined she would have felt at peace with herself, too. But now something disrupted that strange and wonderful peace that Billy exuded. Once she became aware of it, she began watching him more closely. She felt convinced that he experienced pain, and sometimes enough to cause him to turn away so she wouldn't see it. But that was all. When she tried to discuss this with him, he'd point to his head and smile. You're thinking crazy. Far down the beach and obscured by the mist, Joe McDermott skimmed rocks off the narrow bands of calm water that separated the incoming waves. Like Callie, he too found it difficult to work that day and for the same reason. Joe didn't want to think about Billy either, but not just because he worried about Billy's health. The buried thoughts that Billy's health evoked disturbed him as much, if not more. As a young man, Joe had led a charmed life in the small lakeside village in which he grew up, the idolized only child of two adoring and infinitely forgiving parents. He eagerly lost his virginity in the age of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, when everything seemed so safe and easy. His life consisted of sports, at which he excelled, a constant stream of adoring females who couldn't wait to have sex with him, and plans to become a great writer of award-winning novels that exposed the darkest side of human existence, of which he had no first-hand knowledge whatsoever. He majored in English, married his high school sweetheart, had a beautiful daughter whom he adored, much to everyone's surprise, and remained a local hero for reasons he never understood but nonetheless believed he deserved. The magic persisted until one late fall day when he parked his car in the dock next to a convenience store with the engine running and the heater on while he ran inside for a quart of milk, leaving his 4-year-old tomboy daughter, love of his life, playing with a toy truck in the back seat. As he stood in the store talking to the proprietor about the weekend's football games, he saw the car roll a short distance down the dock and into the deep glacial lake water below. With vivid, brain-searing clarity, he saw his daughter kneeling in the driver's seat, both hands on the steering wheel, staring straight ahead with a great big grin on her face. He remembered running, diving, the shock of the frigid water, her terrified face, her little white hands pressed against the car window sinking rapidly below him. He surfaced gasping, then immediately dove again, fueled by 20-something Master of the Universe beliefs that he could save her. Time and time again he dove into the frigid blackness, unable to admit that he had failed. Finally, two burly state troopers dragged him out of the water, pinned him down, and refused to let him dive again, no matter how much he cursed and swore at them. By then, two scuba divers had arrived, and they recovered the body several hours later. Nothing quite worked for him after that. His failure to save his child was like a long needle that plunged deep into his psyche and then withdrew, leaving a barely perceptible scar on the surface, but a jagged metal fragment deep within. For years he walled it off, telling himself he did his best and it was over. None of the succession of physicians he visited for the respiratory problems that appeared in the months following the accident made the connection. Tests revealed allergies to certain animals, plants, and trees, the ones he cared about the most. A fitting penance for letting her die, he knew, but never admitted to himself or anyone else. When he finally returned to school, he changed his major from English to forestry and divorced. He blamed himself for the divorce, too. After his daughter died, he could never manage to love his wife as much as he or she thought she deserved. Nor would he allow her to love him. A few years later, his father died of a sudden coronary, and shortly before he moved to Addison, his mother succumbed to one of those non-specific autoimmune diseases that ravaged the body in spite of the best efforts of a raft of specialists armed with the latest technology. All too soon, he thought, she grew tired of their efforts to keep her alive and insisted they let her die in peace, and nothing he or they could say would change her mind. Shortly after her death, his allergies progressed to asthma. When tests revealed even more plant and animal allergies, an allergist prescribed an inhaler and told him to buy an air filter and move to the Arizona desert. He moved to Addison instead. Since his arrival in Addison, Joe had managed to keep all of these memories sufficiently buried that he could work outdoors without too much discomfort. He viewed Billy as his doppelganger, a talisman who enabled him to vicariously observe, if not reclaim, his own innocence, and that brought him a certain measure of peace. In some ways, he considered himself Billy's best friend. But he also knew that, in addition to keeping him sane, Billy's friendship helped him fit into the tightly knit community much faster than he would have otherwise. So in many ways, Billy was his best friend, too. But now something was wrong with Billy, and Joe felt the tightness in his chest again. Worse, Callie had returned, and her return had changed everything. He was jealous of her relationship with Billy. Billy adored her and communicated with her on a plane Joe could never hope to achieve. And she loved Billy. He could see it in the way she looked at him. It angered him that, after all she'd been through, she could do that. Love someone and allow herself to be loved that much. At first he felt sorry for her. But now sometimes he felt like her presence had thrust him into a suffocating emotional roller coaster ride. Even if only a fraction of the rumors he had heard about her were true, that plus her parents' suicides made her worthy of sympathy. At the same time, and even though she sometimes said and did things that hinted at the weight of the burden imposed by her past, he also occasionally saw glimpses of a different Callie, a determined woman with a sense of humor and surprising strength. At such times, unbidden memories of his mother and daughter filled his mind. He hated her for that. Soon thoughts of Billy, Callie, his daughter, and mother filled him with a vicious rage. Fuck 'em! The Rocky Herald flew impotently over the calm water and slammed into an incoming wave. Fuck 'em all! When he angrily turned from the incoming wave, he saw Callie walking toward him, like a ghost emerging from the past. The barrier came up immediately, and his glib public persona slid rapidly into place, cloaking his roiling emotions. Callie had walked about a mile up the beach in the fine mist thinking about Billy when she noticed the figure ahead skimming rocks off the water. Probably trying to bean a fish for dinner, she thought, when she drew close enough to recognize Joe McDermott. Not feeling in the mood for four-letter banter, she turned and headed back the way she came. Callie! The sound of her name overtook her before she had taken two steps. "How come you're not working in the woods?" she asked when he joined her. "Decided to take some time off. What are you doing here?" "Same thing. I didn't feel like working at the house without Billy." "I wanted to talk to you about that. The two of you are pretty close, aren't you?" "What of it?" The idea that Joe might think anything lewd about her and Billy instantly made her defensive. "He's losing weight, and he gets tired a lot faster than he used to." Joe's words instantly crystallized all of Callie's own thoughts into a cold, hard knot in the pit of her stomach. An ugly image reared up, and she cried, "Oh, God, I didn't mean to overwork him," in an effort to dispel it. "Callie, calm down. You don't overwork him," he assured her firmly. "In fact, you're easier on him than anyone else in town." She forced herself to pause long enough to control her emotions. "Where is he?" "I asked him to wait for delivery at my place because he looked so tired when I stopped in to see him this morning. I told him you wouldn't mind." "Of course I don't mind, but if there's something wrong with him, we need to find out what it is." She told Joe exactly what she had been telling herself for more than a week, words she had been too frightened to act on. "I tried to get him to let me take him to see a doctor, but..." Joe's voice trailed off, and he looked at her through the gloom. "But he either said no or that he'd only go with me." She finished his statement for him, feeling so utterly negligent she feared she'd burst into tears at any minute, the last thing she wanted to do around him. "Yep, so I came over here to figure out how I could ask you to do that." The casual grin that lit up his face when he said that immediately relaxed her. "Do you have some problem with just asking me?" "You know that shit about men being from Mars and women from Venus?" he asked with a chuckle. She nodded. "Well, you and I are more like Mercury and Pluto, or maybe even that new planet they found beyond Pluto. We just can't seem to have a meaningful conversation." "That's because you usually don't want to talk about anything meaningful." "I'll set up an appointment for Billy tomorrow," she promised, then added, "See, wasn't that easy?" as much for her own benefit as for his. "Yeah, and on the off chance that I might be on a roll, when are you going to fuck me?" A statement that made her laugh again. "We've been through this before, Joe. We have nothing in common. The Mercury-Pluto thing. You said it yourself." "What's that got to do with it? I just want to fuck you, not talk to you. Besides, we do have some things in common." "Like what?" "Well," he thought for a while, "you like cows and sheep. I eat them. That sort of thing." His answer was so outrageous the idea of taking him home to bed occurred to her, but then she remembered the cats. "How about we get a pizza and talk about this some more?" she suggested instead. "Can't, hon," he said, patting her on the head. "I've been invited to a pig roast this evening." That night, Callie switched from sleeping with the cats to drinking water again. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.